I was driving across the bridge. I drive across the bridge from San Francisco to Oakland quite a lot. And it's one of the deep challenges in my life. So anyway, I'd like, been waiting and waiting, like move 3 inches, stop, move 3 inches, stop. And this car just really nosed its way in front of me without indicating, and I put my hand on my horn, like, ah. So the driver goes like this to me, and I go like this back. And I surprised myself actually with the vehemence with which I did it. And I'm saying this because I want to acknowledge how sensitive we are to the energies around us, and how one kind of energy can elicit one thing, and another kind of energy can elicit another. And so, this car didn't, this driver wanted to do their own thing. And that moment, that moment of, I don't care about you, I'm getting in line, even though, I've jumped the line and now I'm going to get into your lane. Just what a strong rush of irritation and anger came up inside of me in that moment. And it reminds me also of when I went to the Immigration and Naturalization Department in San Francisco to do my citizenship test. And I walked into the building, and I have never, and I've gone into prisons, but I've never experienced such a profound negative energy as I did walking into that building. It was intense. And so I'm walking in, and there's all these chairs, and one person in uniform, sort of further down the room, and I go up to him to say, where do I go? And there was such, I don't know if I want to say hatred because it wasn't personal, but there was such a profound negative energy. I felt as though I'd been punched in my stomach. It felt visceral, and I want to acknowledge that again because in the political climate we're in, it feels as though we've been punched in our stomachs. Or at least we feel as though the climate is being infused with unskillful energies, with fear, with defensiveness, with anger, with deeply troubled expressions of hearts and minds in distress. And the ramifications of that are really intense for many people living in our communities. And I want to acknowledge how much that environment triggers our own reactivity. It triggers our own insecurity and our anger or our feelings of despair or lack of agency or paralysis or depression. And not that those responses are wrong or bad. Rather, how much the Dharma or this practice invites us to allow that sometimes those are the responses that are coming for us, and how much it makes sense that they are, because that is the conditioned response. That is the way the mind has been habitually conditioned. Our hearts have been habitually conditioned. That is how it is. And it is scary to be in a country where someone has, where someone who is so troubled in so many ways has so much power. In my community, in the mission in San Francisco, I know several people who have been deported, who've been living in the mission for 20 years, who have kids, who've been born in San Francisco, and how they've been forcibly deported. So the ramifications are real. And then, in this environment, how do we respond? And you probably all have been thinking about it a lot and have probably have been talking about it a lot at SIMS. And so I want to talk about it as well. I want to respond through three doorways. And the first is the traditional response the Buddha invites us to. Which is the response of purification. And then I want to respond through the doorway of compassion, and then also and in more length through the doorway of joy and cultivating joy. So I first want to respond with how this is an invitation for purification. And what comes to me right now is a diagnosis I got after I had back surgery from my doctor, which is that I wasn't really going to be able to walk again easily and without pain. And the intensity of the fear that I felt, and the grief and the hopelessness after I went to see him, and actually a lot of anger as well. So that range of feelings, and how what a process it was, and it reminds me of the process that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talked about when we go through an acknowledgement of our death, that it is a process, and that at first we have all these responses and reactions of anger or grief or denial, and then slowly it begins to sink in. And then there comes this moment, right, where it's stark. It's like, this is it. I've gone through my anger, I've gone through my denial, this is it. And that moment of sweet surrender, where it's like, this is it, this is it. And I can either remain in this kind of virulent rage. I mean, it's not a cognitive process, but I'm naming it, right? Or there's some place where I say, okay, This is my path. And the path is to drop the storyline of what the doctor said, right? And to feel what my feelings are. And to trust that in that process of feeling the feelings, I will find my path through whatever it is, of whatever the healing is. And here we too have the equivalent of a nation, right, challenge with many of the understandable responses, and what our hearts are calling to is, how can I drop the storylines of what's being said and how I'm thinking about it and come to feel the feelings? And as I drop the storyline and come to feel the feelings, my heart opens. I come back into connection with the vision that is being lost, which is that life is beautiful, that I and you are beautiful, that I and you and everyone in this country and in the world or life are deserving of caring and respect. And that, right, is the path of purification, where whatever is happening that triggers something inside of us, we then have the opportunity to heal. Because really, the issue is that these energies have been awakened, and this is what makes us beautiful, that we have the capacity to heal them. Whatever we're feeling about our bodies, our relationships, our families, or the world, we have this capacity. And not that it's always easily accessible. It took me many, many, many months on my journey around my back and a long time around living, healing the energies of the impact of apartheid on myself as someone growing up. So I'm not saying it's easy, but I am saying it's pretty amazing. And it feels miraculous to me sometimes that we have this capacity to heal these energies. And that the single most important part of that capacity is dropping the storyline. And how sometimes that is so important when the storylines are so seductive. And there are tweets and news, like, it's like an addiction talking about what's going on all the time, really. It's pretty, like, everywhere. And just dropping that and coming to feel the feelings in the body and coming to balance. So, and from that balance, coming out again to address the ways that we feel called to address the situation, not from fear, but from this inner connection of how can I support this vision of life as sacred, all life as sacred? How do I support the vision of all life deserving respect? That's one. And then the other, I want to begin with a story that some of you have heard, which is an experience I had when I was traveling down Highway 1 many years ago and came upon something called the Medicine Wheel Gathering. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a gathering for herbs. And it turned out to be an indigenous gathering. And I went in with my partner at the time, and there was a circle of people sitting on the ground, and there was a woman with a long wooden pipe. And she was smoking the pipe and sending blessings out with, like, she could make these real, like, bubbles of smoke blowing in. It was very amazing. And so we sat down in the circle, and it was a beautiful energy. And then this young woman stumbled into the circle who had that disease where her face was very deformed. And her legs were very, very big, and the skin was hanging over her ankles, and the skin was hanging over her eyes, kind of. And she dropped in front of the pipe smoker, who was Evelyn Eaton. I don't know if any of you have heard of her, indigenous woman who was living in Lone Pine on the other side of the Sierras in California. And she said, "I want to die." And Evelyn said to her, "The earth is in pain, and she has given each of us a part of that pain to carry." And then she blew these puffs of smoke at the woman. This is what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says when he visited the United States, and someone asked him in a small audience how it was that Buddhists have developed such a wonderful path for overcoming suffering, while Christians, this is what they say, I don't agree with this, have been wallowing in their suffering for 2,000 years. The Dalai Lama responds by saying, "It is not as easy as all that. Suffering is not overcome by leaving pain behind. Suffering is overcome by bearing pain for others." And I know in the Tibetan tradition there is the Tonglen, where you take in suffering and you give out wishes of loving kindness and well-being. But it is true, isn't it, that in our commitment to end the cycle of violence, wherever we find that violence, whether it's systemic in our political system or whether it's in our own families, we hold the impact of the violence that we're receiving. We are bearing the pain of our culture, and we're bearing it by holding it and not continuing to act out and increase those cycles of violence. And I know that it's probably true to say that for every place where I have received violence and not reacted in kind, that I know, I understand, I am holding the pain and the suffering of those who were violent. And that's what the Dalai Lama is talking about. And I feel it, you probably do too, what it means when we hear what's happening, that we each, in our own ways, are bearing or holding this pain. And there is something very dignified in that, isn't there? I I feel it so deeply, the dignity of what Evelyn Eaton was asking this young woman to do, and what these times are asking of us, is to do the work of bearing the pain of ignorance and the violence that comes from it. So then, Emma Goldman comes to my mind, and her classic statement, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. And so in the context of the purification process, and in the context of bearing pain, which we're being asked to do whether we wanted to or not, right? Then there comes a practice that strengthens the heart and mind and gives resilience to allow us to continue on this journey, and that is the cultivation of joy. It's easy in these times, and I have some friends who've been going from demonstration to demonstration, from meeting to meeting, to think that's all that we need to do. But no, it is so important to take the time to practice, intentionally practice the cultivation of joy. It is one of the great antidotes to a heart and a mind that is tired, overwhelmed, or despairing. And it isn't like some sort of new wave thing. It's actually part of the Buddha's teaching. So you might know that in the seven factors of enlightenment, right? Mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, calm, concentration, and equanimity. So actually for the mind and heart to open, the cultivation of joy is seen as critical. It's in the four divine abodes. And it's cultivated both in meditation but also in a particular practice that's given in a series of commentaries called the Visuddhimagga, and that is what I'm going to talk about next. So just to begin, we all sort of have a sense of what joy is, but this is the traditional definition. It's called piti in Pali, the language that the Buddha spoke. And it has the characteristic of happiness, delight, and satisfaction. It pervades mental states, giving them these qualities. The rapture of joy fills the mind and body with lightness and agility, and this is its function. It makes the mind comfortable. So there are 11 ways to develop and cultivate this joy and rapture. And the first is wise attention. The second is remembering the virtues of the Buddha. The third is rejoicing in the Dharma. The fourth is rejoicing in the virtues of the Sangha. The fifth is rejoicing in your own virtue. The sixth is remembering your own generosity. The seventh is considering the virtues of the devas, or those disembodied other consciousnesses. The eighth is reflecting on perfect peace. The ninth is avoiding persons overwhelmed with anger. The tenth is reflecting on the suttas. And the 11th is inclining the mind towards joy. So I'm going to go through, oops, sorry about that. Not very joyous, was that? I'm going to go through some in more detail than another. So to name the obvious, for those of us who've been practicing for a while, being present, connecting to our experience, like not, that sounds so technical, right? But that sense of being, I am here. And not just I am here, but I'm here and I know it. And I'm, that word respect keeps coming up this evening, and I'm in a relationship of respect to this being, myself, who is here. That type of connection brings joy. Or it could be when we are present to something beautiful, like the sunset or the sunrise, or to music. I was just reading the New York Times today, and there was an article about this young musician, and they meant to remember his name with you all. A New York musician, New Orleans, musician, and he's sort of very up and coming. And I was like, I don't know him. I'm going to go online. And just like, there's something about being coming on for 67 and being so out of touch with young African-American hip-hop jazz musicians. So I'm like, I'll go online. So I go on YouTube and I type in his name. And he is this amazing trumpet player. And as I sat listening, that moment of my presence and his musicianship was so beautiful, it brought joy. Something you all at some point probably have experienced with music or art or dance or whatever it is. So the joy that comes from being present. I know that's so obvious, and yet in our daily practice, it's easy not to remember that by practicing daily, being present, however we do it, brings us this capacity. And then remembering the virtues of the Buddha. I do this Dharma talk relatively frequently because I love it. And every time I read what I'm reading to you now, it gives me a tremendous amount of delight, because it is rare to hear of a human being who has no unskillful qualities at all. That when the Buddha reached enlightenment, all his greed, his longing and wanting and hatred and anger and confusion and envy and jealousy, gone. And just reflecting on a human being who is pervaded only with the beautiful qualities, it is sort of delightful, isn't it? So this is what they say about him. I want to say there are 40 pages. I'm not going to read all 40 pages of the beautiful qualities of the Buddha, but this is just a little bit. He is accomplished and stands utterly remote and far away from all defilements. They cannot come near him. They are destroyed. His speech is always true, correct, and conducive, and welcome to others. He does not speak the untruth. He is not incorrect. He does not bring harm in his speech. And that is deeply inspiring to me, because I work with my speech all the time, and I there's no way I could say that about my speech. Such speech he knows to be true and correct, but conducive to harm and displeasing and unwelcome to others, he does not speak. And such speech he knows to be true and correct, conducive to good, but displeasing and unwelcome to others, he knows the time to expound. And what he knows to be untrue and incorrect and conducive to harm but pleasing and welcome to others, he does not speak. And such speech he knows to be true, correct, and conducive to good and pleasing and welcome to others, he knows the time to expound. He is sublime because of enunciating rightly. Let's see. He has abolished all 100,000 kinds of trouble, anxiety, defilement, described as greed, hatred, and delusion, as misdirected attention, as shamelessness, as anger, enmity, contempt, domineering, as envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obduracy, ignorance, as the three roots of the unprofitable. He is fit to be relied on by everyone. So, it might be that you are new to Buddhism and the Buddha, and that that doesn't quite do it for you. And in that case, it is totally fine to think of someone else who exhibits beautiful qualities. And I want to where is it? I want to quote Bishop Tutu, because Bishop Tutu has been one of my heroes. And so when I can't sleep, I do this practice of thinking about the beautiful qualities of the Buddha. And then I go through various other people that I have either heard about or know. I know Bishop Tutu, who are exceptional beings and who exhibit these a lot of beautiful qualities. And it might be that they're teachers in your life or other people you've read about. And it's said that if you contemplate them and their beautiful qualities, it actually does become the condition for joy. This is what Bishop Tutu says. And I'm reading this quote because it's in the context of a tremendous amount of homophobia that's going on. I just went to South Africa recently, and there's a lot of homophobia, especially in the Black African community, and another lesbian just got murdered. And so one of the conditions that contributes to that is that a lot of the churches, the Episcopal Church and Dutch Reform Church, are very homophobic. And you might have heard that there are countries that actually make it so illegal to be gay or even to support homosexuality that you're not, your life isn't taken, but you are in prison for 20 years. So this is what Bishop Tutu says. He says, I would refuse to go to a homophobic heaven. No, I say I'm sorry. I would rather go to the other place. I would not worship a God who's homophobic. And that is how deeply I feel about this. I am so passionate about this as I am as passionate about this as I ever was about apartheid. For me, it's the same. I think that's so beautiful. So, taking the people that you have really been moved by, and I want to just name a few. Fannie Lou Hamer, Leonard Peltier, who's been imprisoned since 1976 and never ever expresses anger and hatred, even though there are many, many people, including him, who say that he's innocent. Berta Caracas, who was an indigenous leader in Honduras, who was murdered a couple of years ago. Daisy Bates. Kamala Nehru, the wife of Prime Minister Nehru, who encouraged women to participate in the freedom struggle. Dorothy Haight, who organized workshops to assist freedom schools and provided for low-income families, was the president of the National Council for Negro Women. Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Lydia Becker, Helen Taylor, Frantz Fanon, Emma Goldman, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, James Baldwin. But some of my list, you probably have a list as well of contemplating the beautiful qualities of people who have inspired you. And then contemplating the beautiful qualities of the Sangha. Let me come back to my notes here. Traditionally, we contemplate, when we contemplate the virtues of the Sangha, we contemplate those who are fully enlightened. But as there aren't that many people around who are fully enlightened, it's lovely to contemplate the support that each of us gives to each other in our practice, and to remember wherever we are and however we are that there are beings all over the world who are facing the same challenges in the field of the Dharma and practicing with them. It's just a really beautiful contemplation. But I particularly wanted to skip over because time is getting on. I wanted to talk about contemplating our own virtue and our own beautiful qualities. And the Buddha is so explicit in this, how important it is over and over again, every day, to reflect on your beautiful qualities. And the first set of beautiful qualities we're invited to reflect on is the ways that we refrain from harming, the ways that we live according to the precepts. So the reflection at least for today, I'm going to assume that none of us has murdered another human being. We might take that for granted, but it is an amazing gift that we give each other, that everyone we know is safe. And safe because of the work that we have done in refraining from taking life. All that, you are giving the gift of safety in people's, with people's belongings. That it's safe to assume for most of us, we are not going to go back to the coat rack and look at one, some of the coats there. I like that coat. I think I'm just going to take it because I like it. Just an incredible gift we give in not stealing or in respecting each other's sexual boundaries and not forcing ourselves on someone else, not abusing through our sexual expression, or the ways we struggle to tell the truth, to call up the courage to say, hey, you know what? I'm feeling uncomfortable right now with what happened. Could we talk about it? Or the invitation to refrain from gossiping negatively about someone if they're not present in the room. Or even the ways of refraining from speaking out some of the grumpy, hateful thoughts we might have about other people, that we refrain from saying it. The ways we struggle to create cultures of safety through our speech. It is such a deep healing to give that gift. And the Buddha says, reflect on it every day, the ways that you create safety and the gift of fearlessness for the people in your life. And take joy in it. And then finally, that you do not break the precepts through getting really drunk or getting very high. You know, we can be so blind to our beautiful qualities. And then he says, contemplate your generosity. Like little things as well as big ones. Like contemplate you made a cup of coffee for your, or tea for your honey. Or that there you were in line and you let someone go in front of you. Or that you are generous in how you volunteer for SIMS. Like, or for Lotus Sisters. Like, I hope you appreciate your generosity over and over and over again. And the Buddha specifically says, you do not have to keep thinking of new places. You can go back to the same evening you volunteered. You can milk it and take joy in it. You know, in our culture, it's really not okay to, well, America's different. I grew up in England, and it was super not okay to brag. You know, and even here, so I'm going to brag to you for a moment. So I went to Pepperdine University and got a master's in organizational development and management, believe it or not. And so I wrote my exam and I was convinced I failed. And I didn't get a letter, and I heard from other people that they had got their letters saying they passed. And so I was even more convinced that because I failed, I was getting the last batch of, you know, who failed. And then I got this phone call, and it was from the manager of the program. And he said, "Irina," and I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'm calling about your exam results." And I was like... And he said, "I'm calling, we wanted to call you to let you know that you wrote an exceptional exam. And we didn't want to just send you the letter." And do you know, I didn't tell anyone. Because you don't brag. So I get to share it with you and have joy in my accomplishment. So I'm going to end there because I've been talking for almost an hour and that seems plenty. And I know I didn't get really nearly as much into it as I would like to, but I am going to practice renunciation and end with a poem, one of my favorite. I bought many, but maybe I'll do this new one. It's called Blessing by John O'Donohue. Maybe some of you know it. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the gray window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colors, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. Let's take a moment to sit. Thank you.